We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is Mraz. Today's show was unlimited, with great moments, laughs, and good takes. Here is the best of today's show.
We begin with one of the biggest questions entering this NFL Week 11, which was, what will the Saints look like without Drew Brees? And if it's Taysom Hill, what will he look like as a starting quarterback? He finally got the nod after all of these years with the Saints and multiple Drew Brees injuries. Sean Payton finally had the faith, finally had the trust in Taysom Hill to start him yesterday against the Falcons. Now, Sean Payton admitted it was a really difficult decision, and that he went back and forth on it all week long. And there were reports yesterday that some Saints players were not happy that he decided to go with Taysom Hill over Jameis Winston. But Taysom ran for two touchdowns and led the Saints to a victory. And at the end of the day, it was certainly clear that Taysom Hill provided something that Jameis Winston could not. A lot of athleticism and speed while carrying the football and leading to some big chunk yards and or touchdowns on the ground. Drew Brees is out for at least another week. I would assume it's going to be much longer than that with multiple cracked ribs. We saw that could be up to 8 to 10 cracked ribs in the collapsed lung from last week. Can Taysom Hill keep the Saints dominant and grab a one seed in the NFC? It is where we begin your cold open.
Hill fakes the handoff, looking to throw. Running out to his left, looking downfield. He's going to tuck it and run at the 10, the 5. Touchdown, Taysom Hill! And there you see it. Deuce, you get down in the red zone, and boy, he is a weapon.
First start ever in the NFL. You know, I think he called one formation, flipped around the wrong way. There was one motion, and then, yeah, all of that kind of calmed down, and he got very comfortable with the flow of the game and did a good job. We did a good job up front, I thought, blocking him.
I don't believe it!
The most amazing, sensational, dramatic, heart-rending.
It's DA's top story.
Here he goes.
It's your cold open.
Zach Strieff, the voice of the Saints on Saints Radio, Sean Payton after the game. Okay, so here's the bit. The latest report is that Drew Brees has 11 cracked ribs. I mean, how many ribs do we have anyway? 11? So that's like one that's not cracked in his entire rib cage? That's a lot of cracked ribs. So I think that those optimistic projections that Brees is only going to be out for 2 weeks are ludicrous. I think that he's going to be out for longer than that, which means yesterday was a really important first step for this Saints team in trying to make sure it locks down that number one seed. And the fact that they got a win while the Packers got a loss is a big deal. I thought that early in this game, Taysom Hill proved that this offense was a far cry with him under center, and something that we had wondered. I know I had wondered for years, why does Sean Payton keep talking about Taysom Hill as a backup quarterback if he never throws any passes? And so the early part of this game was pretty obvious. Taysom was really struggling, and the Falcons defense was holding him down. And the only thing that the Saints offense could muster in the first half of this game was basically that early field goal. And it just looked ugly, and it looked inconsistent, and it looked lethargic, and it just looked like, you know what, the Saints are not going to be able to pull this one off. And then in the second half, as Taysom Hill settled down, he started to move the football. Now, I thought that he got better throwing the football slightly, marginally. I thought the big deal was running the football was where he was making big plays. And that's the part that I just don't know about. If Taysom Hill can keep this thing going over the course of, let's say, 3, 4, 5 weeks. Because running the football was where he created two touchdowns, that 25-yard scamper that ultimately led to the fumble that he lost. But those were big plays. I thought throwing the football was a little bit less effective. By the third quarter or so, it seemed like Taysom Hill had started to settle down. But I wonder, with more defensive schemes thrown out there and defensive coordinators seeing what his tendencies are, now having a full game of film on him, I wonder about Taysom's legitimacy of throwing this football. But the Saints will take wins, okay? And that's the most important part right now. And the Saints right now have ripped off 7 consecutive victories. And when you look at the rest of their schedule, there's imminently winnable games. They've got the Broncos, the Falcons again, and the Eagles. They've got the Vikings and Panthers to wrap up. The Saints have one game that's really scary, and that's home to the Chiefs on December the 20th. But if you're asking Taysom Hill to get them to the Chiefs game and be 4-0 under him, that's doable. Broncos, Falcons, Eagles, that's doable. So I thought that Taysom Hill ultimately got the win. I thought by the end of the game, he started to look far more comfortable and effective. I thought running the football is where he's really going to create problems for the opposing defense. But more importantly, you have to get wins here. And the Saints have to try to remain in that one slot for the NFC playoffs, because we know what home field advantage playing in the dome and with a bye does for the Saints. I know there's no crowd, but it's still the Superdome, home cooking, fast track, indoors, and a week off to start the playoffs. It is huge for the Saints to get that instead of going on the road wildcard weekend, divisional round, and the NFC Championship game. It's a good step forward for Taysom Hill. Certainly not a finished product, but the Saints will take it. 855-212-4CBS. Twitter, DA on CBS. I thought the other part of this was that the Saints' defense started to really collapse the pocket around Matt Ryan, make his life a living hell. And for the Falcons as well, I mean, they were limited offensively the entire day. They held the Falcons to just 9 points on 3 field goals yesterday. So if you're looking for a bigger MVP on the Saints maybe than even Taysom Hill, it was the Saints' defense making the Falcons' life a living hell all afternoon long. Whereas we finally got to see Taysom Hill. You finally got to see Taysom Hill over the course of a full game. Do you have faith that he can run this Saints offense now?
I do. I think he progressed better in the second half, as you pointed out. And obviously the run game is just part of it. He's never going to be a complete total pocket passer, but he obviously can throw the deep ball. And if he gets running like he did in the second half, and Alvin Kamara creates a little bit of that balance too, I have no worries that Taysom Hill is going to be able to figure this out, especially because, as you just pointed out, the one thing the Saints have going for him this year, like they did last year when Teddy Bridgewater took over, that they didn't have early in Drew Brees' career, is a defense that flat out gets after it, a defense that can be a strength for them week in and week out if they rise to the occasion, led by Cam Jordan in the pass rush. So I think the Saints are going to navigate this to the Chiefs game just fine, and I think if you're a Tampa Bay Buck fan, watching the Saints just all over the Falcons and Matt Ryan yesterday, that had to have been the big letdown moment for you, thinking, even with Drew Brees out, this may not be enough to get us to this division title.
Kamara only ran for 45 yards and didn't catch a pass. The first time in Kamara's career, he did not catch a pass. So it was an important step that the Saints proved that they could win without Kamara being a huge part of the offense. Now, look, the Falcons season is lost. The Falcons are dead in the water. So it's not necessarily a good indicator against a playoff-caliber team. But the thing is, the Saints don't play playoff-caliber teams the rest of the way besides that Chiefs game. So that's a big deal.
And Kamara was effective once they got inside the red zone. I think what happened was the Falcons just keyed in and would say, you could beat us with your arm, beat us with your own legs. You're not beating us at Alvin Kamara as soon as we get down the field. But the moment they were in the red zone, Alvin Kamara, that was where he had the bulk of his damage and had that big touchdown run as well. So, yeah, I think that that's all on the table here, that the Saints prove they can win in a variety of different ways. And that's an enormous step for them. And to be honest, look, yesterday you didn't have Jameis Winston throwing picks and throwing them out of that game. And I think that's more important than anything, is just to manage it.
First half, though, boy, it looked like that Sean Payton made a mistake. That first half was
ugly
for Taysom Hill. They could not do anything. They mustered only that field goal. And you're thinking, what did Sean Payton see in Taysom Hill, and why does he keep sticking with him? But it paid dividends in the second half.
CBS presents this program in color.
An educated person can't think he's going to get a recruit by strippers coming in.
They can fire you, but they can't eat you.
And they run through our ass like through a tin horn, man, and we could not stop them.
The audio you need to hear. It's DA Soundcheck.
Welcome back on a Monday morning, man. It's also a day to ask the pros, where you, the listener, gets to ask a question brought to you by O'Reilly Auto Parts. Simply tweet at me, DA on CBS. You could use the hashtag AskThePros and be listening later on. Think O'Reilly for all of your car care needs. Guaranteed low prices, excellent customer service at O'Reilly. Better parts, better prices every day. One note on that Taysom Hill open that we were discussing. Taysom Hill, Drew Brees. Brees has 11 cracked ribs. A human being, including Drew Brees, as superhuman as he sometimes seems, has 24 ribs, 12 on each side. So he's got 11 of the 24 cracked. The Saints did put him on IR on Friday, meaning he is forced to miss a minimum of 3 games. So Taysom Hill and or Jameis Winston have the next 2 starts at minimum before Breeze can come back and activate it for week number 14. On to the best audio of the day. We begin with Ryan Day, Ohio State head coach, after the Buckeyes survive a scare from Indiana on Saturday, and his starting quarterback Justin Fields threw 3 interceptions in the win.
Overall, I thought he played really gutsy. He made some big-time throws, and they were blitzing. We knew they were going to. They're blitzing every snap. I mean, literally every snap. So there was going to be negative plays. There was going to be some big plays, and that's kind of how it played out. And you know, we did have 607 yards of total offense.
28-7 at the half. 28-7 at the half for the Buckeyes. And it looked like they would run away with it. They scored as well early in the third quarter. It was 35-7. Now remember, Vegas put this line at 20.5. So by the time we got to the third quarter and the Buckeyes are leading 35-7, it was a rout. The blowout was on. Buckeyes were going to race away with this. And it seemed like, right, the Hoosiers were good against bad teams in the Big Ten. But once they met their match, one of the best teams in college football, they would get exposed. They were getting exposed. This is what it was going to be, 35-7. And then, dadgummit, as they say, that Hoosiers team kept fighting, kept battling, would not go away. They forced Justin Fields into 3 interceptions. And in the third and fourth quarter, the amount of open space that Indiana's quarterback, Michael Penix Jr., was able to find was startling. And while Ohio State held on for the 42-35 victory, Ohio State had to stave off the Hoosiers in the final 10 minutes of that game because Indiana had brought them to within 7 with 10 minutes to play in the game. There was multiple chances for Indiana to tie things up. Justin Fields didn't have a great day, that's for sure. I thought, though, the more startling part of this was Ohio State's defense allowed Penix to just scorch them. In the second half, Penix threw for nearly 500 yards of this game. He threw for 491 and 5 touchdowns. And when you were watching it, almost all of them came in the big play variety. I mean, there were big plays to be had for everybody. Fry Fogle had a 63-yarder. Miles Marshall had a 68-yarder. David Ellis had a 51-yarder. They were just running free and also making really good catches against some coverage as well. But beyond Justin Fields, he's had a phenomenal season. I'm thinking, boy, what does Alabama with Mac Jones look like against Ohio State's defense in a playoff game? What does Trevor Lawrence with Clemson's attack look like in a playoff game? Because Ohio State's secondary got absolutely manhandled by Penix and the Hoosiers. Good fight shown by the Hoosiers, just not enough as Ohio State remains undefeated. Washington quarterback Alex Smith has been playing now for the last couple of weeks and starting after his unbelievably startling injury and nearly losing his leg, nearly losing his life. One of the most difficult injuries for any NFL player ever to have come back from, nearly amputation. But yesterday, Washington actually got the win over the Bengals. Here was Alex Smith.
You know, it's one thing to obviously come out and even to get that first playing time and whole nother deal, obviously, to play winning football as a starter and felt like we had one last week get away from us. So amazing to get a win.
Look, it's a great story. Alex Smith didn't have to do a ton yesterday, 166 yards, a touchdown, an INT. But Washington did enough, put up 20 points, 20-9 victors over Cincinnati. So great story for Alex Smith. The guy's got the heart of a lion to come all the way back from this, to still start. Great job. Number one, man, if you're Dwayne Haskins, you got to be like, what the hell? And this is on Dwayne Haskins, okay, by the way. I'm not shifting responsibility. This is on Dwayne Haskins. But the fact that Ron Rivera would prefer to have Alex Smith throw for 160 yards and manage a game to win instead of having Dwayne Haskins in there tells you all you need to do know about Dwayne Haskins. They don't trust his work ethic. They don't trust his focus on the offense, on the scheme, on the huddle, on anything. And that's why Haskins ain't playing. They trust Alex Smith, even if Smith is wildly limited in what he can do. Number two, you know, yesterday's game is really defined by Joe Burrow. I mean, Joe Burrow's injury is the storyline out of yesterday's game. Unbelievably, Washington has a chance at this division. We'll talk about this coming up here after the break. We'll talk about the reprehensible NFC East and that every team is now still alive. But yesterday, the game is really about, unfortunately, the injury to Joe Burrow and less about Alex Smith. But no question, it's a great story and a great story of perseverance for Alex Smith even to be out there and gets a win yesterday over the Bengals. And finally, here's P.J. Walker. You might remember P.J. Walker, Texas Ranger, from his XFL days back in the spring. He was a roughneck, and yesterday, because of Teddy Bridgewater's injury, he got the start for the Carolina Panthers under Matt Rhule. And Carolina gets the 20-0 shutout victory over the hapless Detroit Lions. Here's Walker.
It's crazy because I didn't actually envision this start. My mom did about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. She called me and she was like, man, I had a dream that you was playing with the Panthers. And I was with the Colts still at the time. And I had a dream he was playing for the Panthers, and I'm like, really? What's weird? You know, just me being in Indianapolis at the moment, and life just come full circle, man, and her dream came true. Mine did too today.
Wow, that's pretty wild. Imagine having the specific dream a year and a half ago that your son is going to play for the Carolina Panthers and win a game for the Carolina Panthers. That's pretty crazy. That's also a really cool story for all of us that are big spring football honks, whether it's the Alliance or the XFL. We all had a rooting interest in P.J. Walker getting it done yesterday, and he did against Matt Patricia, who has to be the worst defensive mind defensive coach ever. Am I right? I mean, Matt Patricia has to be the biggest bozo going, considering he's a defensive coordinator / coach, but his defense really stinks. But then again, his offense does as well, so who am I to judge? And that is your sound check. Mraz, I know you had a rooting interest in P.J. Walker yesterday. I know you have a soft spot for all those spring football guys.
Right. Even if I was AAF over XFL, the idea that spring guys can succeed, anytime Logan Whiteside comes into a game, Garrett Gilbert comes into a game, mm-hmm. Greg Ward with the Eagles playing wide receiver. I sit
Young
at the edge
Hoo
of my chair.
Koo, right?
Young Wei Koo. Koo, are you?
Koo, Koo, Koo,
Koo, Koo, Koo. Spring football is littered all over the NFL, proving once again there's plenty of quality players in it. And watching P.J. Walker just torch Matt Patricia's defense, I know it was only 20-0, but still, it felt like a torching when the Lions were doing nothing offensively themselves, put a smile to my face. These guys belong. And I've now seen him and Garrett Gilbert, they belong on an NFL field where the biggest problem with spring football is, oh, who's going to play quarterback? We got two guys now who show they can step on an NFL field and compete.
When the XFL shuttered its doors back in the spring, the Houston Roughnecks were in first place in the legendary XFL West. They were 5-0. 5-0. Tough division. That was a P.J. Walker 5-0 team for the Roughnecks. Do you want to play a little spin the wheel of XFL?
Sure. Step on down.
XFL West. Roughnecks were 5-0. In second place, 2-3 Dallas. What was their nickname?
The Renegades?
Correct.
Okay.
Tied for second place at 2-3 was Los Angeles. Do you remember LA's nickname?
The Avengers.
Want to take another guess?
Oh, it was not the Avengers. I don't know.
The Wildcats.
That's right. Okay.
LA Wildcats. And then in last place at 1-4 when the XFL stopped play in the XFL West with Seattle. Care to wager?
The Dragons.
Correct. And then the XFL East, which we always knew was much more about, you know, having a bunch of teams grouped together, a very parity-stricken division. We've always said that about the XFL East.
Correct.
They were led. There were three teams tied for first at 3-2. Number one was D.C. Care to wager what their nickname was?
The Defenders, led by Pep Hamilton.
That is correct. In second place, St. Louis. They were?
The Battle Hawks.
That's right. Number three, your hometown New York?
Guardians.
Yes. And number four, the Tampa Bay?
Oh, this one's a tough one. Because they had the stupid lime green uniforms. They had Aaron Murray. I'm going to say, oh, wait, they're a snake team. They're a snake team. Not the Rattlers. They're the Vipers.
Yeah. Well done.
Yes. I knew it was a snake.
7 out of 8 XFL teams. You got them all except the LA Wildcats, and you had to scrounge late to find the Vipers. But you're right. They were the Vipers.
Yes. Yes. I'm the man.
That's got to be as good as you felt in a long time taking a test.
It absolutely. Look, and that's one of those situations. I know I'm never going to get 100 on a test. And that was the story of my life right there. Dig deep and think about little memory things. Like you write on an index card. I got lime green and snakes that led me to the Vipers. This is the way I take tests.
As Nancy Mraz said so eloquently many, many years ago, a C gets a degree.
And that is
right
it.
There.
That
you
is
got
it.
A better than a C.
That's right.
The XFL pop quiz. Wouldn't you love if you just walked into college one day and that was your pop quiz?
Oh, imagine instead of some of these dumb math classes I had to take, if they were like spring football 101, and that was 3 credits right there. Oh, forget about it. From the USFL to the Alliance to the XFL Arena League, I'd have a ball. Now you want to talk about A's. A's would get you a degree.
Please write an essay on Tommy Maddox's efforts in the first ever XFL Bowl.
Oh, it'd be great. Schwartz could speak to the class. It'd be a whole thing.
Standing by with our headlines is a kind sir. His name is Andrew Bogish. Mr. Bogues, saw you on social media over the weekend. Looks like you had a big weekend, you and the fam. Did some cool stuff.
Missus had another birthday this weekend, so got out and about. Beautiful weather on Saturday. Walked in the beach near Pete's house. Once again, Pete would not come see me in person. That's 0-2 now, being in Pete's neighborhood and turned down for a visit. But other than that, it was a really, really nice weekend.
What did Pete use as his reasoning behind not being able to connect with you?
He was looking for a house. So, I mean, maybe that's real.
Boy.
Maybe that's the easy way out. I don't know.
We've heard of that before. He's out today, so we can't ask him directly about this. But, boy, so you're 0-2 going to his neighborhood. He wants nothing
to do
with
that.
No,
that did not happen. So let's go back and take a look at that.
I actually thought for a sec, wait a minute, is Pete actually here?
Yeah, me too. That was a perfect drop by Connor. So you're 0 for 2 going to Pete's neighborhood, huh?
Yeah, 0 for 2. One was the beginning of the fall, end of summer, and they were at the in-laws' house. And then this Saturday morning, and again, with all due respect, last minute decision by us to go near Pete's house. So it makes perfect sense that Pete was not home, but he was not home again. So you guys have your romantic pumpkin beer drinking stories, and I've got just looking at the outside of Pete's building and never actually meeting Pete's kid yet.
I just don't like him.
I came out for you when you came to my neighborhood. Remember that?
That's true. Don't like you did.
Him. Well, also, Marez dressed up as the Easter Bunny for your kids.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were like a side effect. You were going somewhere else as the Easter Bunny, realized that we were near you, and you swung by, which is nice, but it wasn't just for us.
But it still counts. I was in the neighborhood, and I was home. What we're learning here is I'm there for everybody. Pete is not. That's what we're learning.
Pete is not.
What?
I like how Bogues phrase it as going near Pete's house. Like there's an electric fence around his house. There's a moat that he dug around the complex that we couldn't get close to it. We could only get so close because Pete has security on us. You can only go so close.
If he could have those things, you know he would as well. That's the problem. He's looking for a house with a moat on Long Island. Very limited availability.
Sorry, Pete. Mr. Limited. There's only one moat, and it's a $7 million mansion in East Hampton. Yeah.
So. And by the way, what we're learning from these Jobs Cotter's plan is that Pete really never has to come to work, and we can just think he's there. He's a soundboard.
Hey, watch it, Mraz. We've done the same bit with you, okay? You've been out. We've played 10 drops, and it didn't sound like it's anything different.
The Capuettos and the – I forgot the other team. The Mariettas?
Yeah. That's the two coaching staffs in the XFL West. The Philadelphia Eagles, who actually have their quarterback healthy, lose again in embarrassing fashion to fall to 3-6-1. And yet they lead the division. When you see that graphic on your TV screen during games, after games, NFL Network, CBS, what have you, and you see the playoff picture, and it has the Eagles in there at 3-6-1 because they lead the most grotesque division, arguably in NFL history. It's sad. It's real sad. They're 3-6-1, and they lead the division. But here's the wrap. All four teams have three wins right now. All four. You've got a 3-6-1 Eagles team, and then 3-3-7s. Mraz, I know you are cut from the same cloth as the listeners, the viewers, and the fans that like to do win, loss, win, win, loss, loss as we go down the schedule. And so are you ready? I'm about to give you in the crystal ball exactly what's going to happen the rest of the way in the NFC East. Are you ready, Mraz?
Not only am I ready, DA, this is exactly what my 9 p.m. Eastern hour was like last night. So I am more than ready to hear your take on win, loss, win, loss.
With bacon, cue the music. Okay, so it's going to start off on Thanksgiving with Cowboys against Washington. I'm going to give you what I think is going to happen the rest of the way with all of these teams, okay?
Okay.
Washington-Dallas coming up on Thursday. I'm giving the win to the Cowboys because they were at home. Maybe found a little something yesterday as Andy Dalton led them to a victory. I'll give the Cowboys the win there, okay? You all right with that?
Yeah, I think Washington's winning, but it's a coin flip, so I'll give it to you.
Here is the rest of what I see happening with Washington. I think they lose Thursday on Thanksgiving. I think they then lose the next three as well. They're at Pittsburgh, at San Francisco, home to Seattle. Okay, the Niners are banged up and brutal, but I don't know if I trust Washington going to the West Coast and winning. So those are my three losses. I think they also lose Week 17 at Philly. I think the only win in there for Washington is home to Carolina Week 16. And even that,
right,
I'm dubious about. But I think that they'll find one win in the final 5 weeks of the season. I put them at 4-12, finishing last place in the NFC East, okay?
Goodbye, Washington.
Next, I'm looking at the Philadelphia Eagles. The Eagles, they have to play the Seahawks coming up at home. then they're at Green Bay, then they're home to New Orleans, then they're at Arizona. They're going to go 0-4. The Eagles are going to go 0-4. Home to the Seahawks, at Green Bay,
yeah.
home to the Saints, at Arizona. They're losing all of those games.
I mean, how is that offensive line blocking any of that? What is Carson Wentz doing versus any of those teams?
Wentz against Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, if Drew Brees is back, but even if not, and then Kyler Murray. So the Eagles are going 0-4 the next 4 weeks. They wrap up, though, with at Dallas, home to Washington. They need to win those two games at the end of the season to have a shot of the division, which I joked about on Twitter yesterday, going 5-10-1 and winning the NFC East. I think the Eagles actually lose at Dallas week 16 and then beat Washington week 17. I think the Eagles go 1-5 the rest of the way, which will put them at 4-11-1. Okay? That brings us to the Giants. The Giants are at Cincinnati this weekend, which I would have said could have been a loss before they lost Joe Burrow. Now knowing no Burrow in there or Ryan Finley, forget it. Giants win that game. The Giants then have to go to Seattle, home to Arizona, home to Cleveland, at Baltimore. A ruthless stretch where they're going to go 0-4. The Giants at Seattle, home to Arizona, home to Cleveland, at Baltimore. All four playoff caliber teams. They then wrap up with Dallas week 17 at home at the Meadowlands. I think the Giants win that game. I think they go 2-4 the rest of the way to finish at 5-11. Which means the Cowboys only have to find 5 wins here to win the division potentially if they can get the tiebreaker. If they find 3 wins, they're going to win this division. They only got to get to 6-10. And I think the Cowboys get to either 6-10 or 7-9 because listen to the schedule. Home to Washington on Thanksgiving. At Baltimore, loss. At Cincinnati, though, now a win. Who's ever going to play the Bengals? They got to win that game right now that Joe Burrow's out. They're home to the Niners. They don't have to go across country. Home to the Niners. Niners are completely banged up. Home to Philly. The Eagles are a mess right now, and they get them in Dallas, and then they're at the Giants. As much as I don't like the Cowboys, as much as they're an inherently flawed team, we see CeeDee Lamb make this incredible acrobatic grab. They still have Ezekiel Elliott. They still have these wide receiving options. The Cowboys, I think, can actually win 4 of their final 6. I think they can beat Washington, Cincinnati, San Francisco, and Philly. Even if they split the Washington-Philly game, the Washington-Philly games, it still gives them 3 wins. They're going to be 6-10 or 7-9 and win this GD division. Whereas I'm telling you this right now, the Cowboys are going to win this division at 6-10 or 7-9. Book it.
I don't want to sound like a homer. They're not. The Giants are winning this division, D.A.
Okay, find me the wins for the Giants.
I will tell you right now. You're overestimating one thing here. The Cowboys were awful before this Dalton injury. They're still awful. They lost to a Kirk Cousins-led Viking team that proved to be frauds yesterday. The difference is the Giants are going to find a way to beat the Cleveland Browns, and they will win one of the Cardinals-Seahawks-Ravens. Probably not the Cardinal game.
What gives you the confidence that they're going to beat the Seahawks in Seattle, Cardinals at home, or the Ravens?
The Giants are the only team in that NFC East that's competed with the big boys in the NFL this year and lost these tight games, and now they're finally turning a corner and getting better. There's one thing you could bank on when all those teams play the Seahawks and Ravens. The one team that's not going to get blown out in that division is going to be the Giants. A bounce of the ball is going to go their way in one of those games. Right now, who knows what the Ravens even look like in Week 16 if the season falls off the rails, too. They're reeling.
Well, the Giants, even if they find one of those wins in there, they're going to be no better than 6-10.
I agree.
That's their ceiling at 6-10. So they would have to win the division at 6-10.
My belief is week 17, Giants-Cowboys is your Sunday night game for the division title. Winner at 6-10 takes the division. That is what I believe will happen, and I think the Giants at home will get it done.
So it's going to be 2 5-9 teams,
yes,
in
five
week
and
17.
Ten, yep. Whatever it is. Yeah, 5-10 teams. Yeah, 2 5-10 teams. Week 17 at the Meadowlands on Sunday Night Football for the NFC East title, Giants and Cowboys. That is my belief. And I think the Giants will win that game.
The Cowboys have more winnable games here. The Cowboys have a more winnable final six games.
But they got to prove they could do that. The Cowboys haven't competed in a lot of these games where the Giants have.
Well, wouldn't you say you give them at Cincinnati?
You have to because Burrow's out. Absolutely. The Niner game, though, that's not going to be easy for them.
I don't think the Cowboys can beat the Niners at home. I mean, look at the Niners
They absolutely can, but the Niner defense against Andy Dalton still, that's going to be difficult.
And then they get the Eagles at home.
Here's really what it comes down to. If you really want to believe that the Cowboys are not going to win the division, the Giants will, Washington wins on Thanksgiving. If Washington wins on Thanksgiving based on Washington's schedule, I think the Giants could waltz to the NFC East by week 17.
waltz at 6 and 10.
They could waltz right in at 6 and 10. I'm really not trying to be a homer. That is the team playing the best of those four teams, and they didn't play yesterday, so it's what have you done for me lately?
Well, no, I think the Giants have been incredibly impressive in lack of talent and still being competitive. I've given Joe Judge a ton of credit. I just don't see them winning at Seattle, home to the Cardinals, or at Baltimore. I just don't think they win any one of those three games. If you want to give me a coin flip on the Browns at home, maybe, because... I mean, let's face it, the Browns are winning ugly right now. But I don't think there's any way the Giants are anything better than 3-3, which would put them at 6-10, as you said.
Will you at least admit that in those games, based on what we've seen this year versus all these great teams like the Rams and Bucks, the Giants are going to be in those games. Like, those are not going to be games where they get bullied and pushed over. And I got to think, unlike the first half of the year, a break is going to go their way in one of these games if they're in these games and have played their ass off to make sure they're one-possession games. Every playoff team the Giants have played has been a one-possession game. They suck!
I don't know. All I know is this. The Eagles are going to lose their next four games.
Oh, they are. The Eagles are dead.
Which doesn't mean they're dead in the division because they have Dallas and Washington week 16 and week 17. You have to win both of those games, and then you are 5-10-1, and that tie might be the difference if everybody else is 5-11, which is insane. Right. But they're going to lose their next four, and then they've got Dallas and Washington. Their best case scenario right now is 5-10-1, which is a sin.
Right.
The fact that the Eagles are going to be 5-10-1 at best is a sin.
That's a terrible job by Peterson, Wentz, and company. And the thing about winning those two games versus the NFC East, and I know they're bad, if the Eagles lose all these games in a row, are they suddenly going to get back up in week 16 and 17 to beat Dallas and Washington? Or have they checked their bags and ready to bow out?
Maybe so. The NFC East comes down to basically three games. It comes down to this Thanksgiving, Washington against the Cowboys. It comes down to week 17, Cowboys-Eagles. And it comes down to the week 17,
Cowboys-Giants.
Giants-Cowboys.
Yeah, right.
No, week 16 is Eagles-Cowboys.
Yeah.
So those are the three games. They will decide the division, and somebody is going to go to the playoffs, maybe 7-9, likely 6-10 or 5-11 or 5-10-1. And that and the fact that they will host a playoff game is so remarkably stupid.
It is.
It's dumb that they should even have an automatic bid by winning the division, but if you want to do that, fine. There is no way. 5-10-1 or 5-11 or 6-10 should be able to host a playoff game.
It is a total joke. But we take it, we get it. And if that stupid Evan Engram had caught that pass on that Thursday night versus the Eagles, the Giants are 4-6 right now and waving goodbye to everybody else as they run away.
Waving goodbye. Goodbye to Lou, 4-6.
And the Eagles would basically be on like a 10-game losing streak before week 16 and 17. It's unbelievable.
It's electric.
All right, that's your NFC East breakdown. The Joe Burrow injury yesterday makes everybody sick to their stomach, which says something about Joe Burrow. The Bengals stink. They are going to be, once again, a bottom five team, a top five pick in the NFL draft. The Bengals have been an afterthought and a punchline for many, many years. And the fact that Joe Burrow goes down with that knee injury yesterday and the entire NFL world gives him salutes on Twitter and has this outpouring of sympathy and everybody is heartbroken, goes to show you the type of player Joe Burrow is. Burrow does everything right. He does everything right. Burrow's attitude is positive. Burrow's leadership is obvious. Burrow's talent is wonderful. Burrow makes no excuses for losing these games. He's not blaming his coach or blaming his wide receivers or blaming his offensive line or blaming his team. He's just out there competing. And it makes you sick that that hit ends up ending his season. Sounds like it's a torn ACL. He has already tweeted, "See you next year. You won't be able to get rid of me that easily," which is just, again, perfectly the perfect tone as well, that I'm here. You can't get rid of me like that. Gives a little levity. Perfect tweet. My sinking, my concern is that this takes him out of the beginning of next year. Because if, of course, that injury to that leg, what we saw yesterday, you're just like, of course he's not going to play the rest of the season. Their season's over. There's only a month and a half left to play. Get him out of there. Fine. But it happens around Thanksgiving. And if the ACL tear takes a full year, does this take him out of the first half of next season, which would be brutal? If he misses the final six games of this year, no big deal. But now he's rehabbing a significant injury all year, spring, summer, beginning of fall. Let's see. Early diagnosis is there might be more damage than just the ACL, but who knows about a timeline there. Everything about that, though, is sickening. Defenders going low on him, hitting his knee, it buckling, writhing in pain, getting carted off, torn ACL, ending his season. Every part of that is brutal and miserable. And I just think it says a lot about him as a young man that immediately everybody kind of felt this pit in their stomach, because I think through his run last year at LSU, people really grew to feel like they knew him. I was thinking, if Justin Herbert tore his ACL, people would be like, oh man, that's a real bummer. But I don't think there would be this innate connection that a lot of people seem to have with Joe Burrow. And some of that, I think, had to do with last year he had just such an unbelievable season that he was in our living rooms every single week. Then he gives that really heartfelt, honest Heisman Trophy speech. Of course, he wins the Heisman. But he talks about poverty and illiteracy in his hometown and home region of Southeast Ohio. We see him get drafted by a bad Bengals team and immediately take over the reins and be a leader from day one. And he just makes no excuses. He is competing with that Bengals team, and he's just doing everything that you want to see from a rookie number one draft pick. And for him to go down, it really was crushing yesterday. It really, really was crushing. And the hope here is just that Burrow does not lose a chunk of next season with this. Thankfully, health, wellness, science, surgery is so much better than it ever was. So he should be able to recover at some point in time. But I have to say, watching him writhe on the field, I'm thinking back to Carson Palmer in the playoff game 05, Kimo von Allhoffen in that hit, which disrupts his entire career and trajectory with the Bengals. And for really old-school football fans, Greg Cook, who was their first-round draft pick back in 1969 or 70, I believe, and he had this unbelievable rookie season, and he ends up getting injured, his knee gets torn up in the early 70s, and he's never the same. And they felt as though he was Terry Bradshaw with the Bengals, and he just never developed into anything because of injuries. And back then, they couldn't fix your ACL. I mean, that was basically a death sentence for your career. But I'm just thinking about another charmed, young franchise QB for the Bengals that deals with a knee injury early in his career, and it just taking the breath out of you, sucking all of the oxygen out of the franchise. Hope for the best for Joe Burrow, man. That dude's a stud.
For the first time this week, we're stunned.
Woohoo!
It doesn't take much to surprise this bouncing baby boy.
This is honestly the most stunned I have ever been on the show to a news.
The DA show is stunned to a news.
So a relatively small sinkhole opened up last week on a Toronto street. That's not really stunning. The color of the liquid in the sinkhole is the problem here. It was neon green, like ecto-cooler green, something completely unnatural that should not be under our streets. maybe they needed the actual Ghostbusters to fix this. As you might expect, since it's 2020, conspiracy theories abound about what this green stuff was. Unfortunately, the neon green water, totally harmless. The color is from a
unfortunately.
Dye.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that local authorities use to trace where the water came from so they know what's causing the sinkhole so they can repair it. Nothing ghostly, nothing poison, nothing dastardly. It's just neon green dye to fix the problem.
I haven't seen Ghostbusters 2 in a long time, but isn't this the central point of Ghostbusters 2, that there is a green ooze? Oh, no, it's a pink ooze that is coursing through the subways of New York City in sinkholes.
Correct.
Okay, but that was a pink one. It wasn't green, right?
And it was definitely more viscous than this. This was just green water. That was actual ooze slash slime in Ghostbusters.
And the pink ooze slash slime, which is underground in New York City, is like the representation of anger from New Yorkers. Is that... Do I remember the... The plot of New York, of Ghostbusters 2? Is that that?
Well, D.A., that's the second to last movie you've seen, so you should know this way better than me and Bogish.
It's true. It's true.
Pete would know this, by the way.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
So, there was a story like this a couple of months ago during the summer where, did you see, in Michigan, I think outside of Detroit, there was green goo that was pouring out of a pipe on the side of the road.
Right.
And they had to have a road blockade set up, and people are like, why underground here in Michigan is there green slime and ooze coming out of our water system? Is this a problem? Authorities were like, no big deal. This is just normal. And people are like, I don't think this is normal. And they tested it, and they're like, yeah, this is definitely not normal. There's high levels of toxic things, sludge, chemicals, what have you, that are poisoning the water system. No, it's fine. It's fine. Your water's supposed to look green and glowing. That's actually an additive to it. Which also in Canada, they're usually good about that type of stuff. So surprising that there was green goo. If this was New York City, then I would definitely buy that.
Canada's good at not having neon green in their water, basically.
Yeah,
they're good at that stuff.
They're usually responsible. Usually accountable. Unlike us here in the States. All right, thank you, Bogues.
Smiling like Little Mo every morning. It's a momentous Monday.
Every day can be a better day despite the challenge. All you gotta do is leave it better than you found it. It's gonna get difficult to stand, but hold your balance. I just say whatever, cause there is no way you're grounded.
I just think people should know that if you stay positive, everything will be fine. You just eat, drink, and breathe positive thoughts. That's all you gotta do, and everything will be good.
So cool to see ESPN do a profile on Little Mo and his legacy on ESPN's NFL pregame show yesterday. I tweeted out that entire video if you want to watch that. My Twitter handle is DA on CBS. I want to introduce you to Stephen Ludwig, who is suffering from Maffucci's disease. Only 150 known cases of this disease, but it causes abnormal bone growth. He's had over 22 surgeries. He battled cancer, leukemia, and it's all because his skeleton grows in abnormal ways, but he has worked on basketball. He loves basketball his entire life. He is now a senior in college at UNC Chapel Hill. And with this disease, he wears a 9-inch lift on his left leg because his left leg is much shorter than his right leg. He stands at about 5'1". But he has worked on his jumper. He's worked on his handle. He's worked on his dribbling. And he plays pickup and rec basketball all the time against people much older than him or full strength, full size, etc. And Stephen Ludwig, once upon a time, through Make-A-Wish, because they gave him an 11% chance to live, had a Make-A-Wish to go to the NBA All-Star Game in 07 where he met Kobe Bryant. And full circle, Stephen Ludwig wants to be able to play in the NBA celebrity game. Here's Stephen from his Instagram.
Yo, what's up, you guys? It's Steve-O. Please take a second to hear me out. I have a huge favor to ask you. I don't even know if it's possible. But like many other kids around the world, my dream growing up was to be in the NBA. Unfortunately, I have a bone disease. I battled leukemia, thyroid cancer, graft-versus-host disease, and 22 surgeries. But besides all that, I legit thought I was going to be in the NBA. So after beating leukemia, I used my make-a-wish to go to the NBA All-Star Game in Las Vegas. That was the closest thing I would ever become to being an NBA player, or so I thought. My dream now is to inspire the world. Hear me out. Imagine seeing me in the 2021 Celebrity All-Star Game. I'm not a celebrity by any means, trust me, I know. But seeing me out on the basketball court with a short leg, short arm, doing what I love the most, will help motivate people all across the world. And for all you doubters, trust me, I'll be able to hold my own out there.
It's pretty cool to watch his videos on Instagram. He's got millions of followers on TikTok. People are inspired by his story. He's got an amazing attitude. And that was always the lesson of Little Mo, man. Your situation doesn't dictate your attitude. Your circumstances don't dictate your attitude. You dictate your own attitude. And Stephen Ludwig, Steve-O, as he's known by his friends and buddies and pals, is one of those guys, one of those people that does not let his circumstances dictate his happiness. He is an amazing, amazing guy. And I would love to see this happen, to see Stephen, who has a 9-inch lift on his left leg because it's that much shorter than his right leg because of abnormal bone growth, and a shorter arm as well. He can drop some threes. He's got a good outside shot. He can drive. He's got good handle. So it's been pretty cool to watch. You can check him out on many social media platforms and read about him. Stephen Ludwig, a.k.a. Steve-O, who deals with Maffucci's disease, is your inspirational, momentous person on a momentous Monday today. Derek Carr played well. The Raiders played well. They did about everything you have to do to beat the Chiefs. But they couldn't slay the dragon. They could not kill Freddy Krueger on that final drive. And on that final drive, I just said, Mahomes will figure out a way to do this. And then he did. It was the least predictable. It was the most predictable, rather. The most predictable outcome of that final drive. That Patrick Mahomes, needing a touchdown, would drive down the field and score the touchdown to win on the road and to rip the hearts out of a Raiders team that had played their guts out last night. Really think about this. Because I thought about this long and hard. Tom Brady's in that camp. Maybe not Tom Brady right now, but certainly Tom Brady for about 10 years. He'll get the football, big spot, division game, on the road, at home, whatever it is, he'll figure this out. He'll win. He'll find the end zone. He will win. I don't think you said that about Peyton Manning. I didn't. And I love Peyton Manning. I always loved Peyton Manning. And I think that Peyton Manning sometimes has done a historical disservice because he played for so many years at such an incredibly high level. But at the end of the day, as a very distilled sports landscape and media and fan base, we distill everything down to just championships. And he had only one of those when he was the most important part of the team. His second championship comes when the defense is the most important part. Peyton Manning didn't always find ways to win. Oftentimes he did. He was often sublime. But plenty of times he did not just find a way to win. Aaron Rodgers, again, as great as Rodgers has been to watch, there were plenty of times where Rodgers lost a game he shouldn't lose. Plenty of times he won a game he probably shouldn't win. But you did not always say, and still don't say, don't worry, Rodgers will find a way to win this game. Before this generation, Brett Favre made plenty of mistakes, threw them out of a lot of games. Guys like Steve Young and Troy Aikman, we did not say that about. Before that, Montana. Montana, for about an 8-year period, maybe 82, 83 through 90 or so, Montana gets the ball back, you lose. That's it. That's the guarantee. Now, he wasn't perfect. He had some playoff losses in there. But by and large, more often than not, Montana has the ball in his prime, down whatever, in a divisional game, on the road, at home, primetime, whatever it is. He's figuring out that way to do it. Before that, maybe a Roger Staubach. You could not say that about Dan Marino. There were plenty of times Dan Marino did not end up figuring it out. Jim Kelly, Troy Aikman, go down the list. Great quarterbacks. Great. But they didn't always win. John Elway, an amazing comeback artist. Winner of two Super Bowls. But there were times, especially in Super Bowls, where he didn't figure it out. Patrick Mahomes is in this incredible rarefied air where for these three seasons as a starter, he always figures it out. And year one, he would have went back to the Super Bowl had his team won the coin toss. I mean, he wasn't even on the field in that overtime. Last night was just a remarkable thing. You can just set your watch to it. He'll figure it out. He's extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. And right now, he's thrown for 3,000 yards. We have six games to go. He's thrown 27 touchdowns. We have six games to go. He's thrown two picks. Last night was his second pick of the year. He's going to end up finishing with 4,500 yards, 40 touchdowns, and like four interceptions. And the Chiefs will either be the one or the two seed in the playoffs. Now, that's a huge differential this year because only the one seed gets the bye this year. So the Chiefs, if they don't catch the Steelers will have the bye in home field. The Chiefs will have to play wild card weekend at home, divisional round weekend, likely at home, and then potentially on the road in Pittsburgh for an AFC title game if they're the two seed. But damn, we are in that spot where Mahomes just does it, and you know he'll do it. Derek Carr played really well, and I have taken my shots at Derek Carr in the past. I have been critical of Derek Carr. I have certainly done a bad John Gruden impersonation for many, many years. Gruden and the Raiders are a better club today, far better than when he took them over. They have far better young talent. He has found a way to make Derek Carr consistent and confident. And that little wink at the line of scrimmage where Carr sees something on the Mike linebacker and winks and kind of smiles, it's a great football moment. That's a guy that's in control. That's a guy that's confident. That's a guy that's seen everything and he knows what's coming. And that's a really unique situation as well. Carr played great last night. But he's not Patrick Mahomes. Mahomes right now, and I don't want to jinx anything because you just want to see this unfold naturally and authentically, but Patrick Mahomes is on a trajectory to be one of the four or five greatest quarterbacks that's ever lived. And I know it's only a little bit more than 2.5 seasons into his starting career, but again, what he's doing is so unbelievably historically rare. Mraz, any doubt in your mind when the Chiefs got that football back, needing either a field goal to tie or a touchdown to win, that he would score the touchdown?
There was no doubt that he was going to score the touchdown, and it just shows you that the Chiefs, because of Patrick Mahomes, are the one team in the NFL that you need to play entirely different and throw out the book and coach like you know you can't get a stop, even though the Raiders have found ways to stop him this year at times. But there was a moment yesterday where the Raiders lined up at 14-14 for a field goal, and I know they took a penalty, which inevitably had to get him a field goal, but they were bringing the kicker out anyway, basically from the 1 or 2 yard line. And I remember yelling at the TV that you just can't do this. Like, you can't kick field goals, you can't punt on fourth and shorts, and expect that you're going to stop Patrick Mahomes enough times to win a game where if you would do those things versus almost any other quarterback in any other team in football. You have to play Patrick Mahomes like you're playing a game of Madden. and basically go for it and not allow him to have as many possessions to score touchdowns, because he will score touchdowns more often than not. It's insane how differently you have to play him compared to other teams.
You have to have a two-score lead with only a couple minutes to go.
Right.
And you just – if you have a one-score lead and he gets the ball, you're toast.
Yep.
You have to build a two-score lead with about 3 minutes to play. And that's what the Raiders did remember when they went to Kansas City earlier in the season. They had a two-score lead for most of that game. They just – time runs out on the Chiefs if you have that two-score lead. If you give them that chance, you are absolute toast. I will say, though, that the Raiders are such – they are so much better than they were when Gruden – before Gruden took over. So much more organized. And I thought this was basically a vanity project for him. A nice retirement send-off. $10 million a year, beautiful, right into the sunset. I don't know if he'll be on the sidelines for all 10 of those years. I think we're now in year three of this. Year four, year three. But Gruden's busting his ass. That team plays hard. And he found a way to make Derek Carr pretty good quarterback, didn't he?
Yeah, he has. And Gruden is not really a laughingstock anymore. And it's the thought was, hey, just make them valuable when they get to Vegas. Turns out John Gruden is still probably one of the 10 best coaches in football. I don't really know how you deny that. He seems to have his finger on the pulse. The offense gets coached up. The defense gets coached up. They're disciplined. The John Gruden hire was the right hire for the Raiders, where it felt like such a joke that we were mocking when he was coming out of the booth again.
Yep, because it was Mark Davis and that dopey haircut, and it was the Raiders always just trying to turn back the clock and get the former greatness and being kind of like too in love with their own history and legacy. And bringing back John Gruden, who had become a caricature in the booth, just felt like, oh, yeah, of course, a 10-year deal. Gruden's going to be there on the sidelines for four of those years. 6 years, he moves to the GM spot, yada, yada, yada. This is his year number three with the Raiders. Year number one, they were 4-12, and he turned over the entire roster. He hired Mike Mayock. I thought that was a joke as well, another broadcasting buddy. Turned over the whole roster. They found excellent guys like Crosby, like Jacobs. They found good young talent. Last year went 7-9. Remember, they were 6-4, and then they kind of collapsed down the stretch. That's when at 6-4, Raiders fans were trying to burn down my Twitter. And this year, they're 6-4. And, you know, there's, of course, a potential collapse like last year. But they're a better team than they were last year. I think they're sturdier. I think they're a better team. I think they have better staying power. And it wouldn't surprise me if they end up being one of the wild cards in the playoffs. And it's not a team that you necessarily want to play in the playoffs, because they got some moxie, they got some guts, they got some talent, and it's starting a season. He'll go from 4-12, 7-9 in this year, 9-7 or 10-6, maybe 10-6. That's a pretty good trajectory if you're John Gruden, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it just, you almost feel like if you wonder for John Gruden the rest of this contract, if because you're in the Chiefs division with Patrick Mahomes, it kind of feels like if you were the Celtics or Raptors in the East with LeBron, and you just felt like you couldn't get past that hump because LeBron's sitting there. And I just wonder if John Gruden will never get to where he wanted to get to with this Raider rebuild, if they're always really good at 10-6, 11-5, but because they get stuck in the Mahomes division during the Mahomes peak era, if Gruden never fully relives the glory days of what he went there to get, despite the team being good and competitive.
It's a good point, because I don't foresee the Chiefs having a 10-6 or a 9-7 over the next 5 years, that would leave the door open to sneak in there to win the division instead of having to be a wild card and go on the road for 3 weeks.
Right.
I mean, maybe an injury happens, multiple injuries happen to the Chiefs. Maybe, you know, they win a couple of Super Bowls in a row, and then suddenly they kind of take their foot off the gas. But they won the Super Bowl last year, and you would think that, okay, they can exhale a little bit. They don't even have fans really in attendance at Arrowhead. It's a very sparse, crowded Arrowhead, so they don't even have that juice that they normally rely on. And they're going to be 14-2 this year.
Yeah.
Maybe 13-3, but probably like a 14-2, maybe 15-1 after winning the Super Bowl. That this is not a franchise taking an exhale this year.
Yeah. And by the way, 15-1, and it feels so ho-hum if it goes that way that they'd be 15-1 too.
Right. It would not be a crazy, remarkable accomplishment. Yeah, we could have two 15-1s in the AFC. I still don't think the Steelers go 16-0, but could the Steelers be 15-1 and the Chiefs be 15-1? That's in play. Certainly, Steelers at 15-1, Chiefs at 14-2. Imagine a 14-2 team playing wild card weekend. That's also in play for the Chiefs.
Insane.
Analytics is just a term that's kind of thrown around a lot.
It's time now for the mothership's advanced analytics.
All right, the question today was, who is going to win the NFC East? 45% of you said Mraz's New York Giants. 45%. 24% said the Cowboys. 20% said Washington. And a mere 11% said the division-leading Philadelphia Eagles. It's the worst cumulative record in NFL history for a division, the 08 NFC West, which was 22-42, which is a 3.44 winning percentage. Right now, the NFC East has a worse winning percentage. They're at 3.13. So the worst division ever went 3.44. The NFC East this year is at 3.13. This is my prediction. The Cowboys find a way to actually go 4-2 the rest of the way to finish 7-9 and win the division. The Giants finish at 5-11. The Eagles at 4-11-1. And Washington at 4-12. Even if the Cowboys only go 3-3 the rest of the way. And they've got games against Washington on Thanksgiving, at Cincinnati, the Niners, the Eagles, and the Giants. I think they'll find three wins in there. They'll go 6-10 and win the division. That's right. It's time now for your Ask the Pros question of the day, brought to you by O'Reilly Auto Parts. As always, send us your questions. Think O'Reilly for all of your car care needs. Guaranteed low prices, excellent customer service at O'Reilly. Better parts, better prices every day. On Twitter, MB tweets, listen to you guys in Detroit. We all want Patricia Quinn and Harbaugh fired. It's brutal being a fan of these god-awful teams. Fightin' Amish tweets, gotta love that contractor's pencil and COVID mask combination for Matt Patricia. Who hired this guy anyway? Well, Fightin' Amish, I'm glad you asked. That'd be Bob Quinn. Now, Bob Quinn came from, wait for it, the Patriots. He was a player personnel assistant coach with the Patriots. He was assistant director of pro personnel for the Patriots as well, and director of pro scouting for the Patriots. He gets hired by the Ford family in 2016. And Bob Quinn decides after that, three off-seasons ago now, to hire Matt Patricia, a Patriots assistant coach. This is a Pats, I'll do right by you, you do right by me type of thing. And it's problematic and it's ridiculous. And that's why it happened. Quinn and Patricia need to go. Let's cue up your epic fail of the morning.
Even the DA show is not perfect. We know. Shocking. Here's the epic fail.
Beautiful weather on Saturday. Walked in the beach near Pete's house. Once again, Pete would not come see me in person. That's 0-2 now, being in Pete's neighborhood and turned down for a visit. But other than that, it was a really, really nice weekend.
What did Pete use as his reasoning behind not being able to connect with you?
He was looking for a house. So, I mean, maybe that's real. Boy. Maybe that's the easy way out. I don't know.
Nope, that did not happen. So let's go back and take a look at that.
We've heard of that before. So you're 0-2 going to Pete's neighborhood, huh?
Yeah, 0-2. One was the beginning of the fall, end of summer, and they were at the in-laws' house. And then this Saturday morning, and again, with all due respect, last minute decision by us to go near Pete's house.
You're right.
So it makes perfect sense that Pete was not home, but he was not home again. So you guys have your romantic pumpkin beer drinking stories, and I've got just looking at the outside of Pete's building and never actually meeting Pete's kid yet.
I just don't like him.
Came out for you when you came to my neighborhood. Remember that?
That's true.
Well, also, Mraz dressed up as the Easter Bunny for your kids.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were like a side effect. You were going somewhere else as the Easter Bunny, realized that we were near you, and you swung out, which is nice, but it wasn't just for us.
Fruit Jello! Fruit Jello!
But still counts. I was in the neighborhood. Oh, yes. I was home. What we're learning here is I'm there for everybody. Pete is not. That's what we're learning.
Pete is not.
What? I like how Bogues phrased it as going near Pete's house. Like there's an electric fence around his house. There's a moat that he dug around the complex that we couldn't get close to it. We can only get so close because Pete has security on us. You can only go so close.
Very bland.
If he could have those things, you know he would as well. That's the problem. He's looking for a house with a moat on Long Island. Very limited availability.
Epic fail, you loser.
That is why you fail.
Epic fail.
That's the real rub. Those two inspectors actually said the moat wasn't up to code, so they couldn't buy the house. All right, thanks to Sean Mraz, executive producer of The DA Show. Thanks to Connor Green on the Wheels of Steel today. Thanks to Andrew Bogish on your headlines. And Andrew Kaplan, the Wizard of Watch DA. Tomorrow, Trash Tuesday, Hall of Famer Andre Reed, and two big storylines that are starting to build. The Bourbon Bells fried pickles recipe and the 12 DAs voting. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
All right, football fans, the NFL Draft is almost here, and the Free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. AUDACY. Download it today.